Support comes from Gemma, architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at gemastl.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Journalism in America is under pressure. Over the last two decades, 3,500 newspapers have shut down. Large conglomerates have increasingly taken ownership of local broadcast TV stations. And earlier this month, public broadcasting lost federal funding. Journalism also faces attacks from politicians and, often, public distrust. The Gateway Journalism Review has reported on and held local news media accountable for 55 years. Charles Klotzer and his wife, Rose, founded the publication, initially called the St. Louis Journalism Review, in 1970.
Because there were so many things going on which I felt the public should know about.
That's Charles Klotzer on this show in 2020. This year marks his centennial birthday. The Gateway Journalism Review is celebrating the occasion at its First Amendment event on Sunday, November 2nd. It will feature prominent journalist Marty Baron. Baron led the Boston Globe during its Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of the Catholic priest sex abuse scandals, which inspired the 2015 Oscar-winning film Spotlight. He was also executive editor of the Washington Post from 2012 to 2021. Recently, he received the International Press Institute's World Press Freedom Hero Award. Producer Olivia Mizell sat down with Baron to discuss the current state of First Amendment protections and how journalism can move forward during uncertain times. Olivia began by asking him how the journalism landscape and trust in media today compares to what it was like when he started his career in the 1970s.
Well, I would say it's extremely different. Keep in mind, in the 1970s, we had the disclosures about Watergate. We had the Pentagon Papers disclosure by the New York Times, Watergate by the Washington Post. I think the public could see that the press was serving the public interest. And trust in the press was somewhere about 70% at that time, which was extraordinarily high. The entire makeup of the media industry was completely different. You had a limited number of television networks. You had strong local newspapers that were monopolies or oligopolies in their individual markets. And you didn't have an internet. So there were a tremendous number of differences between then and now.
What was the point during your career that you kind of felt like things shifted the most?
Well, I would say it was the beginning of the 2000s when broadband cable really proliferated. That's what made possible all of the things that we have today. It made possible social media. It made possible video and audio. It made possible mobile phones. All of that started really to take place. Well, certainly the internet was having an enormous impact at the beginning of the 2000s, but then at about 2007, we started to have the iPhone, then we had social media, and everything started to change really at that point.
What about government trust in media?
Well, I don't think government ever trusted the media, to tell you the truth. I mean, the whole idea of having a free press in this country, a free and independent press, the reason that it was drafted as part of the First Amendment was so that the press could keep watch on government. And so there was basically a built-in tension between government and the press. And so as a result, government never really liked the press. John Adams, the second president, was incredibly hostile to the press. He introduced an Espionage Act, a Sedition Act. He was jailing journalists right and left. It was only when Thomas Jefferson came into office that those journalists were released, and then we've had very difficult times since then. Of course, we had Woodrow Wilson was very hostile to the press. He introduced his own Espionage Act. He had a propaganda arm in the White House. He too was seeking to lock up journalists, and of course we had the McCarthy era where. Joe McCarthy, the senator, was looking for enemies everywhere, including within the press and in the entertainment industry, and anybody really who was exercising free speech. And then we had the Nixon presidency, and of course he was tremendously hostile to the press. He had an enemies list that was very, very long. And there were many, many members of the press who were on that list. So there's always been tension between the press and government. That's just a feature of our system. And that's, I don't think that's changed tremendously over the years.
So you were the executive editor of the Washington Post when Amazon founder Jeff Bezos bought the outlet. What kind of pressure did this add to your job?
Well, it's always difficult to take on a new owner. The Post for 80 years had been owned by the same family. It had the patriarch of that family at the time, Don Graham, was overseeing the Washington Post. To introduce someone like Jeff Bezos, who had no background in media, one of the richest people in the world, who had other commercial interests, was obviously a point of tension. I mean, people were wondering what's going to happen. At the same time, he was very supportive at the time of what we were doing. He backed us up, certainly during the Trump presidency, during the first term. And he allowed us to do our work with full independence in the newsroom. And the editorial page and the opinion pages had a tremendous amount of independence as well. And he wanted us to adapt quickly to the digital era. And we set about doing that.
When it came along to Trump's second term, before he was elected, I know Jeff Bezos last minute didn't allow the editorial team to give a presidential endorsement. What changed there? Why do you think he kind of changed his tune and the way he was doing things?
Well, I think he paid attention to what Donald Trump was saying during his campaign, and that is that he would be retribution. He would seek vengeance on his perceived political enemies. It was clear during his campaign that he would do that. He began to do that at the end of his first term. And I think that, of course, I can't get into Jeff Bezos's mind, but I think it certainly seems clear to me that he feared that there would be reprisals against his other commercial interests if he did not repair his relationship with Donald Trump. He was the principal owner of Amazon, the largest shareholder in Amazon. That's the source of his wealth. He is the owner 100% of Blue Origin, a private space company, which is almost entirely dependent upon government contracts. The Washington Post is a small part of his overall portfolio. I think he was concerned about the impact that it would have on that Trump's return to the White House would have on Amazon and on Blue Origin. And he set about trying to repair his relationship with Donald Trump.
We will keep talking a bit about journalism under the Trump presidency, but here in St. Louis, the Gateway Journalism Review has been concerned with those issues for a long time, and that is what's bringing you here. Your presentation at their First Amendment celebration on November 2nd is called The Case for Worry and for Optimism. Let's start with the not-so-great part of that. What is the case for worry?
Well, I think there's a lot. I mean, you know, over the 50 years of my career, I've always known a free press in this country. I took a free press and free expression generally for granted. And now I don't think I can take any of that for granted. There's a majority in Congress that's essentially servile to the president. There's a majority on the Supreme Court that's been highly deferential and has handed him powers beyond what any president before him ever had. I can't be certain these days that the press will fulfill its responsibility to hold a president to account as it should, and frankly, as the founders expected it to do. That's why they, as I mentioned before, that's why they drafted the First Amendment. It was for the very purpose of having a press that kept watch over government. And now you have a president who is doing everything in his power to undermine the press, to sabotage its economic sustainability, to damage its legal position, and to further undermine its reputation with the public. He's attacked the press something like 3,500 times since he entered the political arena in 2015. He's now filing baseless lawsuits against the press. He's putting pressure on owners who have other commercial interests. And he's threatening them with regulatory reprisals, for example. Their mergers won't be completed, or they won't get contracts, or things of that sort. So I'm very concerned about that. There are a whole range of other things I'm concerned about. Obviously, our economic model is a matter of concern. I'm concerned about our inability as a society to agree on a common set of facts, or even to agree on how to determine what a fact is. And I'm concerned about the advent of generative artificial intelligence and the impact that it will have on people's ability to distinguish what's true from what's false. We're going to see, and we've already seen, the dissemination of fake images, both video and still images, fake audio, and it will be very hard for the general public to determine what's true and what's false. It'll be very hard for the press and others to refute what's out there. And meantime, all of that, those fake images, that fake audio will have reached millions upon millions of people around the world before anybody has anything to say about it. And people will get access to it instantly on their mobile phones.
Do you see a path towards repairing this? You know, the second part of your presentation is the case for optimism as well. Where do you see this going?
I feel optimistic. I mean, the reality is that the kinds of pressures that we faced in our industry probably would have led to the demise of another industry, and yet we're still around. There's still quite a lot of journalists, and there are new media outlets that have emerged and succeeded and are delivering information in new and innovative ways. And we as look, the public also is not reacting that well to the president's attacks on the press. The New York Times had a survey not that long ago, a few weeks back, that suggested that something like 60% or more of the general public felt that it was inappropriate for him to do what he was doing. And with regard to actually threatening the licenses of stations affiliated with the major networks, it was 70% who were opposed to that. I think people are beginning to recognize that a threat on the free speech rights of the press is a threat on their own free speech rights, because the rights that we're, you know, the rights that we're asking to we want to safeguard for ourselves really aren't any different from the rights of the rights that all citizens want for themselves. And, you know, that is, I mean, very simply, the right to inquire into the facts, the right to share those facts and what they learn with other people, and then their right to express their opinions on what they've learned. That's it. That's what we in the press are doing. That's what I think most people want for themselves. And if our rights are threatened, then the rights of other people who speak freely will be threatened as well. In fact, they already are being threatened. The rights of scientists, the rights of historians, the rights of scholars of all sorts, you name it. There are late night entertainers, for that matter, comics, artists. That's really what's at stake. It's not just a matter of the press. It's the matter of the issue. The real broad issue is free expression. And I think people recognize that threat.
Yeah. Is there any news story or certain thing you've seen recently that gives you some hope for the future of journalism?
Well, look, I mean, with regard to the president himself, I think the press is doing a good job. I mean, every day there's something revelatory about what's happening in this administration. The press is the frontline press, that is the journalists on the front line, the reporters on the front line, the editors that they directly work for, seem very determined to do their jobs regardless of the pressures on them, the attacks against them individually, and in many instances by name. And I was very happy to see that the press, almost all media outlets, refused to sign this agreement that the Pentagon wanted the press corps at the Pentagon to sign. They were essentially asking journalists who covered the Pentagon to turn themselves into either stenographers or propagandists. That really was the gist of it, is that they would not be allowed to even inquire into anything that the Pentagon did not itself release. That's unacceptable. And I was very glad to see that what I consider to be all reputable news organizations said they would not sign that. It was entirely unacceptable, which it was. And if the administration threw them out of the Pentagon, so be it.
Yeah. So many media outlets, especially a lot of local media outlets, are struggling and they've lost a lot of audience. From your vantage point, do audiences want something different?
Look, I mean, the internet is a different beast than it's different from print journalism. And that's that requires us to communicate with the public in a different way. If people are consuming information on mobile phones, we need to think about what that means in terms of how we structure stories, how we communicate. Clearly, there's an attraction to short-term video now, to podcasts, to you name it. And so we need to learn from that. I do think that local journalism can succeed. There are any number of outlets that are doing reasonably well. My former outlet, the Boston Globe, seems to be doing reasonably well. The San Francisco Chronicle seems to be doing pretty well. The paper in Minneapolis that's now statewide also. And there are a number of nonprofits that seem to be doing reasonably well. So that doesn't mean it's easy for any of them. It is not. But they're holding up. And I think their focus is on how do they provide value, real value, to their readers every single day? How do you give them information that they really need in their daily lives? And they feel that you're doing a job for them. They feel that you're doing a job for them either in terms of providing information that can be of practical value, utilitarian value, or you're giving them information that is of psychic value. They feel that you are, for example, that you are covering their government, their local governments, government entities, in a way that you're serving as their proxy.
Yeah. The paper here in St. Louis, though, the Post-Dispatch, has been struggling quite a bit, losing staff and resources. Do you see a sign for optimism there for papers like that, or will there be some other tipping point?
I'm not an expert on what's happening in St. Louis. I haven't had time to really research that, to tell you the truth. But I think any news organization needs to ask itself every day. They should be asking themselves this at every morning news meeting. What of real value did we provide our readers today? What did we miss? And what are we going to do tomorrow? And they need to be honest with themselves as to how well they did, not pretend that they provided value when maybe they didn't, or they didn't deliver it in a way that was of use to people. They didn't communicate with people the way that they ought to. I don't pretend that that's an easy thing to do. Most of my career was actually with local journalism, and I know how difficult that is. And I know also, you know, the difficulties. We live in a very polarized. We're going through a very polarized period in the history of this country, and people see they view the news through their own political prism, and so that makes it especially difficult. I see promise. I see green shoots out there, and I see news organizations at a local level that have found their way, seem to have found their way, and those can serve as a model for news organizations in any city or in any town.
The Washington Post adopted a slogan in 2017, "Democracy Dies in Darkness," as I'm sure you know. Do journalism organizations have a role in safeguarding democracy today, and should they be explicitly pro-democracy?
Yeah, well, I do know. I was there when that happened. I participated in those meetings. So, yeah, I think we do have a role in that. I think we should be pro-democracy. The reality is that you can't have a free and independent press without a democracy. It will not exist. It's as simple as that. And when you look at other countries, when you have leaders with authoritarian tendencies, authoritarian impulses, practically the very first thing they do is go after the traditional press. They want to quash any independent arbiter of truth, starting with the press, but also moving on to historians, scientists, academic scholars, you name it, politicians who think differently, that's what they do. And so in order for a free and independent press to exist, we have to have a democracy. And in order for a democracy to be a true democracy, there has to be a source of independent information.
So a few years after you started at the Washington Post, President Donald Trump was elected for his first term. We're now in our second term. Have you seen a lot of differences between those two terms, and what worries you the most about his conduct towards the media?
one way after the next. He's really gone after the press far more aggressively than he did in his first term. He's proven himself to be far more vengeful than he demonstrated even in his first term, when he was quite vengeful. And he's, you know, I think that we have a real reason to question whether we've maintained rule of law in this country. He has dictated to the Justice Department, the people it should prosecute, whether the prosecutors believe there is a basis for prosecution or not. There have been recent cases, of course, highly publicized cases, where the prosecutors felt there was no basis for bringing an indictment, and yet he instructed the Justice Department to go seek an indictment nonetheless. So this is the world we're living in. And it's a much more dangerous world, I think, than we witnessed during Trump's first term.
One last question for you here. You're coming to St. Louis pretty soon to talk about optimism and worry in the field of journalism. I myself am very new to this world of journalism. I just graduated college this past May. What is your advice for me and other young journalists entering this industry during this uncertain time right now?
Sure. Well, first of all, congratulations
on
graduating. That's really great. Don't get too worried before you enjoy your happy period. So, look, I mean, I think that as long as we have a democracy, I think we're going to have journalism. That's why I think it's so important that we maintain our democracy. And I think it's really important for not just for the press, but for the general public. They need to be able to participate in shaping their own future. And you can't do that unless you have a democracy. You can't do that when you have a leader who becomes a ruler who dictates everything without your participation. So I think as long as we have a democracy, we'll have an independent press, free press, and I think the nature of it is going to change. I think it's really important that people really understand that technology is, you know, going to have an enormous impact on our work. We need to not just adapt to that technology, we need to embrace that technology and figure out how to use it to greatest effect, to use it for good and not for ill. And I think we just need to recognize that in many ways the media is a lot more like tech companies these days. It's just much more unstable. So I think it's really important that we recognize that the nature of communication is changing. The way that people want to receive information, the way they want to consume it, is changing radically. And we need to change with that and really adapt, not just adapt to it, but really embrace it and learn from those who are succeeding, whether they are in traditional media outlets or in non-traditional media outlets. So, I mean, I always like to tell people that instability is a permanent condition in our business right now, and we need to be comfortable with discomfort. That's just the way it's going to be. And for those who thrive on that, that's going to be, it'll be very exciting. They'll have to innovate all the time, be very agile, keep changing things. For those who want things to stay the same for the next few decades, I'm afraid they're going to be out of luck.
That's journalist Marty Baron talking with St. Louis Public Radio's Olivia Mizell. Baron is the former editor of the Boston Globe and Washington Post. He will headline the Gateway Journalism Review's First Amendment celebration on November 2nd at the Hilton St. Louis Frontenac. More information and tickets are at gatewayjr.org.
This episode was produced by Olivia Mizell.
Audio engineering and sound design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.